Two more planes landing at Sky Harbor were hit by laser pointers last night. Phoenix has recorded the second most strikes this year, more than 180.
They think it unlikely that something as small as a laser pointer could bring down a multi-million dollar aircraft, but it can.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, testimony is over in the contempt of court hearing against Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arizona and the country tries to cut the amount of food it throws out in half.
And some good news on high schoolers getting caps and gowns.
The state's changing their accountability system to value graduation rates more. And hopefully with that enhanced value of graduation rates, we'll see graduation rates rise.
Plus, the law, science, and ethics of concussions and preserving Phoenix's Rock House.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. Valley weather for the rest of the day. We should stay sunny and high temperatures expected to be around 80 degrees. Then for tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with a high of 78. In Valley traffic, an accident blocks the center lane I-10 eastbound at 59th Avenue. There's also a collision blocking the shoulder on the 60 westbound at Alma School. And if you happen to be in the area of I-17 South Bend or Jomax, there are major delays there.
Grand Canyon University is changing its employment policies to provide benefits to spouses in same-sex marriages. The private Christian university located in Phoenix said today its sincerely held religious beliefs maintain marriage is a union between a man and a woman, and those beliefs will continue to be supported in classrooms and curriculum. But the university says it's changing its policies because same-sex marriage is now legal, and the university respects what it called, quote, the system of government and laws that exist today. The university says it made the change as part of an annual review of human resources policies. Five former Arizona child welfare workers who were fired last year amid an agency scandal are appealing a judge's ruling that threw out their wrongful termination lawsuit. The filing asked the State Court of Appeals to overturn Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Robert Oberbillig's May decision dismissing their case. The former Child Protective Services employees argued they were fired to provide political cover to then-Governor Jan Brewer and Clarence Carter, who headed the Department of Economic Security. The state argued they were at-will employees and could be fired at any time for any reason. Oberbillig ruled state law allowed their firings even if they were scapegoats for others' actions.
This morning, the testimony in the contempt of court case against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio finally wrapped up. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block joins us to tell us what comes next in the saga. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Steve.
So, Jude, the contempt hearing feels like it's been going on forever. How long exactly has it been?
Well, today was the 20th day of testimony, so this all first began almost 7 months ago, back in April. But remember, there have been plenty of twists and turns and pauses, including when defendants asked the judge to recuse himself and everything was put on hold. The contempt hearing officially ends next Friday after the parties will give their closing arguments, and then it's going to be up to the judge in the case, Judge Snow, to make his ruling on civil contempt.
And we'll get back to that in a second, but let's take a minute to talk about the testimony in the last few days. It got pretty dramatic with the final witness, cold case posse leader Mike Zullo.
That's right. Zullo is one of the sheriff's most trusted volunteer posse members. He was tasked with the sheriff's investigation of the president's birth certificate and was also central in the Seattle investigation. And that's this mysterious investigation that's been described by the sheriff and others as an effort to expose the federal government for allegedly hacking into Maricopa County residents' bank accounts. But there's also evidence suggesting this investigation involved an effort to discredit the judge in this case, Judge Snow, by linking him in a false conspiracy. So Zullo at first invoked his Fifth Amendment rights to not incriminate himself and refused to answer any of the plaintiff's questions. But then yesterday, he reversed course after lunch and began talking, and he very much wanted to express that he wasn't investigating the judge and that, rather, Judge Snow was a victim of this bank hacking plot. And after court, Arpaio's lawyer, John Masterson, seemed satisfied for how the hearing went overall.
So I think it went well. Certainly the last couple of days, we've been telling you for a long time, we felt the Seattle issue was a side issue, kind of a sideshow, given the ACLU time to throw mud up on the wall against the sheriff's office. And Mr. Zullo explained exactly what happened, and that was that nobody was investigating Judge Snow.
But that's just one side of the story. Plaintiffs showed emails today between Zulu and Montgomery from earlier this year that were referencing looking up information on snow. So that's a point that the two sides still disagree on today, whether there was, in fact, an effort to discredit the judge. And that will likely be a point of debate in closing arguments as well.
And then what about the plaintiffs in the case? How are they feeling after the hearing?
Also positive. They were trying to prove that the sheriff and his team intentionally violated court orders and defied the judge, and that therefore Judge Snow should intervene with strict remedies that will correct all that. Here's Stanley Young. He's one of the plaintiff's attorneys.
I think the evidence in this contempt process and the admission of the sheriff and chief deputy that they did commit contempt cries out for a need for further relief from the court to make sure that the sheriff's office obeys the court's orders and the Constitution.
And the plaintiffs are expected to ask Judge Snow to give the court-appointed monitor more power, particularly when it comes to the sheriff's internal investigations.
Well, now the big question here is criminal contempt. The judge has said he's going to decide whether to refer this to a criminal prosecutor to pursue criminal charges. When does that happen?
The judge has said he's first going to make his rulings in this civil contempt case and prescribe his remedies and then deal with the criminal contempt question. He did say something interesting today. He said if he does decide to refer this to criminal contempt, that doesn't mean that only the people who he's noticed for civil contempt could be included in the referral. There could be others as well who are not on the list for civil contempt that could be referred for criminal contempt. So that's something that could be interesting to watch.
KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block with the latest on Sheriff Joe Arpaio's contempt hearing. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
The ACLU of Arizona today released a mobile app which allows residents to record encounters with police, among other functions. The group has already unveiled the mobile justice app in other states, including California, Oregon, and Colorado. Steve Kilar is communications director for the ACLU of Arizona.
The ACLU nationwide is expanding the availability of this app to Arizona and 9 other states today. In response to rising issues that we've seen with regard to excessive use of force by police and other law enforcement officials across the country. Over the last year, we've seen a lot of viral videos arising relating to excessive use of force, and this has really allowed us to put a focus on police practices that need to be reformed.
Well, how is this app any different than folks just using the video recording functions that are already on their phone already?
The primary difference between just using the video recording function that's in the phone and using the app is that the video that is created is uploaded to a database that's maintained by the ACLU affiliate in the state. So any videos that are recorded in Arizona are uploaded to the ACLU of Arizona affiliate, and we can review the video and look for potentially abusive behavior. And if we see it, you know, we have more regular communications with law enforcement across the state. We can bring these things to their attention more quickly than a normal citizen could.
There are a number of other states in which this app has already been rolled out. I'm wondering if the ACLU affiliates in those states have gotten videos that have proven useful already from folks in those places.
Well, we certainly know that there have been videos that have come up in other states that have increased communication between the ACLU affiliate and the police departments related to their activities. There haven't been any particular videos that have led to any discipline or litigation, as far as I know.
What, in your mind, is the ultimate goal of putting this app out there and encouraging folks to use it?
The ultimate goal of this app really is to raise awareness about abusive police practices and what appropriate police behavior is, and also to tell people what their rights are when they're interacting with the police. People should always comply with police directives when they're interacting with police, but more and more often, you know, we're realizing that people just don't know what their rights are and don't have the opportunity, because they don't know, to challenge abusive police behavior after the fact. And so we're hoping that by having this app on your phone with you at all times, it will raise people's knowledge about what it is they can and should do if they see abusive police behavior.
Steve Kilar is the communications director for the ACLU of Arizona. For a sense of what law enforcement officers think about the new app, we call on Jeff Hines. He's a former Phoenix police commander and currently teaches at both Glendale Community College and ASU.
The mobile app actually is a wonderful thing. If it instills confidence in the community towards their police departments, law enforcement embraces transparency. We embrace people looking at what we do and how we do it. The storyline starts off with negative. It starts out to hold police accountable. Well, the other side of that, from a positive, is law enforcement is not afraid of accountability. Law enforcement invites accountability. Law enforcement is attempting to be as transparent as we can. The community is not only asking for that right now, they're demanding it.
Given the fact that so many people have recording devices in their pockets or in their bags now, does the release of an app like this sort of scratch the radar of a police officer? Would they know that this thing is available and the folks with whom they're coming into contact might have it?
Not specifically apps, but what you have now is every law enforcement officer that works the street is the same as your citizens. We all have the latest phones that are out there, your Apples, your different brands that are available that you just push a button and all of a sudden you're recording. We carry them. The citizens carry them. Our public has them. We are customers, the same customers that the public is out there having the ability to have these devices. An app will accelerate that because what it does is it goes right to a designated site to feed that transmission to. But no, law enforcement has no fear and is embracing the fact that we're being watched, is embracing the fact that people are recording us. And truly, it is not going to change the way we do business. But what it will do is instill confidence in the community that they have the ability to tape us and watch us at any time they want to. No problem. Do it.
So do you think that ultimately having an app like this might in some way improve relationships between the police and the communities they're serving?
Absolutely. Anytime that the community has faith in its ability to hold its law enforcement officers accountable is a good thing. The fact that we're out there doing our jobs as professional, sincere, and as compassionate as we can, and when the community also believes that, not only are we delivering those services, but that those services are acknowledged and recognized, and anything that does that is welcomed and encouraged by the profession.
Jeff Hines is a former Phoenix police commander. He currently chairs the Public Safety Sciences Department at Glendale Community College and is an adjunct professor at ASU.
The Federal Aviation Administration has been busy tracking a recent rash of incidents involving lasers striking airplanes. The FAA confirmed more than 20 aircraft at airports across the country have been hit by lasers since Wednesday, including at least two Phoenix-bound flights targeted just last night. KJZZ's Phil Latzman talked with an Arizona professor who teaches aviation psychology about the dangerous trend.
Yeah, and that trend is hitting home. A Southwest Airlines flight about 8 miles out from Sky Harbor Airport was the first to be struck by a green laser at 4,000 feet about 6:30 last night. Less than 2 hours later, an American Airlines flight was beamed at 10,000 feet. Both landed at Sky Harbor without incident or injuries. But the dangers are real and the odds of disaster are growing. According to the FAA, since October 16th, more than 5,300 laser strikes have been reported across the U.S., many of them here in the Southwest. Los Angeles has the most, followed not far behind by Phoenix. Dr. Aaron Bowen is chair of the Safety Science Department at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott. Dr. Bowen, you're an expert in aviation psychology, but can you put yourself inside the mind of a person who's doing this kind of thing?
You know, that is an excellent question. And the motivations for individuals on the ground to shine lasers up at pilots, I suspect, are pretty varied. And I think most times people genuinely don't realize the danger they are causing.
So we're talking about people that may just be ignorant to the fact that shining a laser inside of a plane in a pilot's face might cause that plane to crash?
Exactly. You've got people who don't think through the consequences of what they're doing. And not only do they not think through the safety consequences, they don't realize that they're risking legal implications as well.
So, Dr. Bowen, how is this rash of laser strikes affecting pilots psychologically? Is it something they think about, especially the commercial pilots, when they're up in the air, they're responsible for so many people and their safety? Are they constantly thinking, oh, when's that next laser going to come shining at me?
Well, that's one of the things we're really concerned about on the safety side is lasers, when they tend to hit aircraft, tend to happen at takeoff and landing, which are periods of high workload, high stress, and really require 110% of the pilot's attention.
Pilots already have issues with long hours and sleep deprivation. Does this only add to the list of problems for modern-day pilots?
Absolutely, and it's frustrating from the safety perspective because it's something that shouldn't be a part of the flight. It should not be an occupational hazard of flying an aircraft.
Why do you think there have been so many of them in Arizona, specifically at Sky Harbor, these incidences of lasers hitting planes? Is it something specifically about the Southwest that makes planes here more of a target for these strikes?
I think part of the reason you might see greater laser strikes in the Southwest is, in part, we have the climate for more people to be sitting outside more of the year and nearer to the airport. I think you're less likely to see someone sitting in 6 feet of snow in New England in the middle of winter shining lasers. So we really do have more of a year-round climate where people are going to be outside, and anytime you have that, you're going to have that associated risk, unfortunately.
So given that it's pretty tough to spot these folks that are using these lasers, what can be done to stop them?
Well, one of the first things that the industry as a whole has been doing is trying to build awareness. And that's really the first line of defense because, as I said, I think most people, not all, but most who engage in this activity don't realize just how dangerous it is. And they think it unlikely that something as small as a laser pointer could bring down a multi-million dollar aircraft, but it can.
Dr. Erin Bowen is with Embry-Riddle University Aeronautical School in Prescott. Dr. Bowen, thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman.
Coming up, increased attention on concussions has medical and legal components.
The assumption of risk is a very big question here. How well did you understand the risks that you are theoretically assuming?
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. With Mark, I'm Steve. We're expecting sunny skies throughout the rest of this afternoon. We may reach a high temperature of 80 degrees, and then for tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with a high of 78. Slight chance for rain on Sunday with a high expected to reach 75. Currently under mostly clear skies, it's 76 degrees at KJZZ. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, an accident I-10 eastbound at 7th Avenue is blocking the shoulder. Also a collision I-10 eastbound at 59th Avenue. There's also an accident blocking the shoulder, 101 southbound in the East Valley at Broadway. You're listening to the show, a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley and the region, along with national and international news. It's 2:21.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center, announcing the holiday tour of saxophonist Dave Koz and guest Candy Dulfer, Jonathan Butler, and Bill Medley, Wednesday, December 16th. Pre-show dinner option tickets and more at mesaartscenter.com.
A report released this week has some encouraging news on high school graduation rates across the country. The Alliance for Excellent Education found between 2008 and 2012, the number of high school dropouts dropped by about 250,000 each year. The organization gives at least some of the credit to federal policy. For more on that, we turn to Philip Lovell, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at the Alliance for Excellent Education.
So in 2008, the Department of Education under President Bush and Secretary Spellings required all states to use the same calculation of the graduation rate so that we could be comparing apples to oranges instead of apples to elephants. The regulation also required action in response to the data. So no longer was it okay to simply report we have a low graduation rate. Now you actually have to do something about it. And what we found is that with that requirement, combine that with local action, and you actually get results.
Now, it seems like in some states there were still sort of clusters of high schools which had poorer graduation rates.
Definitely. Just because there's been an improvement doesn't mean that we no longer have a problem. In fact, there remain nationwide 1,235 high schools that don't graduate at least a third of their kids.
And of those 1,235 high schools, 41 are in Arizona, which is one of the higher numbers nationwide. What does that tell you about what's happening here?
To me, what it says is that Arizona, there's been improvements, but like in many places in the country, there is definitely room for improvement.
How did Arizona's overall graduation rates compare nationally, and how does Arizona seem to be doing relative to the rest of the country?
So Arizona's story is actually somewhat different from many other states in that the increase in Arizona has been there, but it's more level, and there hasn't been as much progress in increasing graduation rates for traditionally underserved students.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that the state is really just now starting to put a real emphasis on graduation rates. For several years, the graduation rates of students of color, for example, weren't specifically included in the state's accountability system. That's actually still a problem. In fact, for a number of years, graduation rates were really not valued very much in the accountability system. That's now changing. Now the accountability system includes a measure for college and career readiness that includes graduation rates. The state's changing their accountability system to value graduation rates more, and hopefully with that enhance the value of graduation rates, we'll see graduation rates rise.
Yeah, do you expect that to happen?
It'll take that plus the dedication of teachers, principals, superintendents on the ground, and you connect those two together, and yes, I'm pretty optimistic. What the national trends have shown is that we can do this when we combine policy with local action, and so certainly I'd expect for the same positive results to happen in Arizona that we've seen nationwide.
What kind of time frame is realistic to look at as far as when those rates might start to come up and sort of match the rest of the country?
So it's a good question, and I mean, really, different states have different trajectories, but when people really put the pedal to the metal and concentrate on this, I've actually been surprised by how fast graduation rates can increase, even if it's just a matter of a few percentage points within a few years. Remember that a few percentage points in a state really means you're graduating several hundred more or several thousand more kids. One of the things that also sets Arizona apart from other states and from the nation is that the nation's increase in its graduation rate has really been driven by increases in the graduation rates for students of color, namely for Latino students and for African American students. But in Arizona, we see those gaps really hovering. And so in order for Arizona to see dramatic increases in its graduation rates, like what some states have seen, there really is going to have to be more progress in closing the gaps between African-American students and white students and Latino students and white students.
Philip Lovell is Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for the Alliance for Excellent Education. Philip, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The impact of concussions in amateur and professional sports and on members of the military returning from the battlefield continues to make headlines. A film starring Will Smith called Concussion will be in wide release next month. It focuses on one doctor who discovers a disease that leads to brain trauma in football players. Today at the Sandra Day O'Connor U.S. Courthouse in Phoenix, ASU's O'Connor College of Law is hosting a conference called Safeguarding Brains: The Law, Science, and Ethics of the Concussive Injury Epidemic. ASU Professor Betsy Gray is the conference's main organizer. Professor Gray, why is this the right time for a conference like this that focuses on the law and ethics of concussions?
Concussive injury management for sports teams, both on the youth level and on the collegiate level and on the professional level. We have, and every state in the union has a statute on concussive injury management for youth sports, for high schools, basically. They focus on various things, but if these advances come forward and we get a much more exact marker for concussive injury, probably will change what we think of as concussive management duties. It'll also change in other areas, too, the duties that we find in law, like domestic violence victims and car accident victims who suffer concussions, but it's hard to tell whether that's true or not. It's probably going to change how we look at those kinds of questions as well. There's a high incidence of concussive injury in military veterans returning back from combat who suffered from concussions, who sometimes have behavioral problems associated with that and have long-term problems. So we are looking at the implications from a legal and ethical standpoint for those kinds of questions as well.
And where does the issue of privacy come in relation to the science of it?
Right.
When we think about certain families donating the brains of people, certainly with the NFL, to see, are we seeing advances in that, and how much will that be discussed?
We will eventually, given these advances in science, probably screen individuals for susceptibility to concussions. And we will find that there is a subset of the population that's more susceptible to concussions than others. And that will be, that screening will go on with youth sports and other areas and professional sports, but it'll also happen for employers. Industrial accidents are a big cause of concussion injury. So the question is, who will be entitled to that kind of information showing susceptibility to concussion, and what can they do with it? And so those will raise a whole host of questions, whether employers, parents, whether health insurers can have access to this kind of likely genetic information, and, you know, how can we control that information?
Are participants in athletics or in the military, maybe just, as you mentioned, an industrial job that may have some inherent dangers, will there be requirements to potentially have people sign waivers to say that, you know that you might be susceptible to concussions, and we want to be sure that you don't sue us later for saying, well, you know, you didn't tell us, or something like that. Is that an issue that we may see in the future?
Yes, absolutely. So the assumption of risk is a very big question here. And one question that always arises with that signing of any waiver is, how well did you understand the risks that you are theoretically assuming? And if you say we're found to be susceptible to concussions, or maybe that would clarify exactly what you're taking on. Now, of course, once you suffer one concussion, you're more susceptible to a second concussion, and that's pretty well accepted, that notion of a secondary concussion syndrome. So does that change your assumption of risk over, say, a season once you suffered one concussion? Is that original waiver still valid, or will that change over time? And it's a question that we don't know the answer to. So all those questions are on the forefront.
ASU law professor Betsy Gray. We've been talking about a conference taking place today in Phoenix called Safeguarding Brains, the Law, Science, and Ethics of the Concussive Injury Epidemic.
From table scraps to whole crates of produce, food waste is a growing problem. And with plenty of hungry mouths to feed both nationally and in the valley, innovative efforts are working to get food into bellies and kept out of landfills. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Andrew Bernier reports.
A new partnership between the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Department of Agriculture aims to reduce food waste across the country by 50% by 2030. With the USDA reducing food waste in farm production, the EPA is working with retailers and consumers. Amanda Hong with the EPA says there's a hierarchy to help with decision-making for reducing waste.
The most preferred solution is to prevent food waste, reduce it at the source. Anything that can't be avoided but is still wholesome and safe should go to feed hungry people. The next best option is to feed animals and then process anything left over to create additional value from these organic resources, which we really see them as resources and not as waste.
The last resort for these resources is often the first.
And only if we can't recover any of that wasted food should we turn to the last resort, which is incineration or landfill. And unfortunately, 95% of the food wasted in the U.S. is currently going into the landfill.
Hong says most businesses don't plan for food waste and throw still good food in the trash. However, she says businesses can save money with with measurement technology up front and connecting with food waste recovery organizations, reducing volume and weight of trash loads.
The greatest barrier to donating good and wholesome food is that there's this fear of liability.
In 1996, President Clinton signed the Good Samaritan Act, protecting food donors from liability if something happens from their donation. Hong says it is now up to technology and organizations providing infrastructure and logistics to connect donors with the hungry.
We're seeing a lot of apps right now to help connect surplus food with those in need. Food serving businesses and events can save a significant amount of money by hiring a professional food recovery service to come rescue all of their excess food.
We pick up between 7 and 10,000 pounds a day with the five trucks.
At 6:30 in the morning, Waste Not Field coordinator David Kaiser meets with a driver outside a grocery store. Having already picked up crates of dairy, juices, and grain, this pickup is heavy with produce. Still perfectly good, just not up to store standards.
We take the perishable items. Like with the food banks, everything needs to be boxed in a certain way, and they don't take the perishables. We don't have a warehouse. What we pick up by 12, 1 o'clock today will be off the truck no later than 2 o'clock.
And what they get can be wildly different any given day. Kaiser says Waste Not delivers to about 20 agencies daily, but it may not always be a well-rounded meal.
We get a fair amount of bread and pastries. It's hit or miss. We could go 2 or 3 weeks without dairy and then all of a sudden get 10 or 15 milk crates worth of dairy or meat. One of our stores called last week and said, hey, we got a bunch of meat that we need picked up. And it was significant, 600 pounds of meat.
By the end of October, Waste Not had rescued over 2 million pounds of food. Still, Kaiser says it's hard to keep up with the hunger.
You know, you knew there was a demand, and then when you get out and you actually see it, that in the wealthiest country in the world, that there's a demand for this much food.
Food that often comes here, the Waste Transfer Station in South Phoenix.
We did a waste characterization study last year, and what we found was about 50% of the garbage is actually compostable. About 15% of that is food scraps.
Standing over a fresh load of inedible food, Chuck Hamster of the City of Phoenix oversees the city's pilot composting program.
Right now we have limited capacity, so we're trying to slowly ramp up. We want to make sure we're maintaining the quality of our product, but we're getting about 3 tons every day that is brought in.
Once food enters the trash, edible or not, Hamster says it isn't economically feasible to recover it for composting. For now, they are dependent on food waste loads delivered separately, which needs to be processed quickly.
The quality and the quantity of the material depends on how fast we can turn it around. So we're testing our compost to make sure it has a good carbon-nitrogen ratio because we want to have sufficient nutrients in it.
Several large piles are in a line after this fresh load is mixed with dirt, starting with a light brown mulch-like texture and then gradually becoming dark and soil-like. Hamster is working with City Parks to distribute the compost to test the product.
We create the compost. It's used on the gardens, the urban farms, the parks to grow things. Those things are used, and then they come back, keeping everything locally as much as possible.
So be it money, food, or compost, reducing food waste can lead to a lot of savings for the Valley. Achieving 50% in 15 years may be tough, but it's an investment goal the Valley is buying into. In Phoenix, I'm Andrew Bernier, KJZZ News.
Coming up, we'll learn about a unique residence in Phoenix known as the Rock House.
The house is made solely of Malapai rock. The rocks are really heavy. Came from Sunny Slope Mountain up around North Mountain Park.
We'll go brick by brick or rock by rock. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Happy Friday. Thanks for listening to the show with Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, I-10 eastbound, a collision at 7th Avenue has the HOV lane blocked. Elsewhere, I-10 eastbound, a collision at 59th Avenue and on the 60 eastbound at Mill. It'll be sunny for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 79 degrees, a few degrees warmer than average. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows right around 50. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 78, partly cloudy on Sunday, slight chance for rain and a high of 75. Right now in Phoenix, it's sunny and 79 degrees at KJZZ at 2:37.
KJZZ is supported by REDW CPAs, business and financial advisors serving the tax, audit, and financial needs of businesses and individuals since 1953. Offices in Phoenix and Albuquerque. Information at REDW.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Pentagon says it is reasonably certain that the Islamic State militant known as Jihadi John has been killed by a U.S. drone attack in Syria. The man was a Kuwaiti-born British citizen who has been featured in videos showing the beheadings of several Western hostages. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren in Baghdad.
We have been following this target for some time. The intelligence indicators that we had gave us great confidence that this individual was Jihadi John. And then with the opportunity for minimal civilian casualties, we took the shot. And now we're using those same intelligence capabilities to verify that the individual we killed was, in fact, Jihadi John.
Warren says no civilians were killed. The parents of one of the men who was beheaded by the militants, American journalist James Foley, says even if Jihadi John is dead, it's small solace because it does not bring their son back. Police in Paris say there's been a shooting at a restaurant there and there are a number of casualties. In addition, there are reports of at least one explosion in the city. An Israeli man and his teenage son have been killed in the West Bank today. NPR's Emily Harris in Jerusalem reports the Israeli military is searching for a suspected Palestinian gunman.
The military says the man and his 18-year-old son were with other family members driving in the southern West Bank when their car was attacked. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it a heinous crime and said Israel will bring the perpetrators to justice. This brings to 13 the number of Israeli Jews killed in Palestinian attacks over the past 2 months. 80 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces during the same time period. More than half, Israel says, were shot as they were committing attacks. Palestinian officials say two Palestinians died today after Israeli forces shot them during clashes. Emily Harris, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Another day of losses on Wall Street. The Dow was down 202 points. The Nasdaq was off 77 today. This is NPR News from Washington.
Imagine you're one of the thousands of refugees currently arriving in Germany from Syria. If you're lucky, you may get a room in what some are calling Airbnb for refugees, a project whereby refugees live in German homes, flat sharing or taking the spare rooms of German citizens.
It's called Refugees Welcome and was started by several students in Germany a year ago. The BBC's Julia Lorck reports on the project. She began by speaking with one Syrian participant named Abdul.
We have attack from ISIS and government. Our friends, they are killed. Sometimes one arrest, one he just lose his best friend or his member from his family. And after the people, they come to my pharmacy and they want to just kidnap me. But thank God I have two doors, so I just run from the back doors. You know, there is no rule anymore, no law, nothing. There is no future.
The 24-year-old Abdul fled from Syria to Germany and claimed asylum. Whilst awaiting the outcome, he found refuge in an overcrowded camp.
So I was there in 2 months, 3 months. I am not comfortable there because there's so many people. One bathroom, and one kitchen, like 30 people. I just see this website in internet and I see they put like form and I must to just fill it. So I fill this form and after they call me and they say there is room if you want.
Abdul's new accommodation in a quiet suburb of Bonn came about through the Refugees Welcome Project. Started by three German students about a year ago, the project has been described as Airbnb for refugees. Since then, it has expanded, with sister organizations in countries including Austria, Greece, Portugal and Spain. David Sistel is from the Austrian team. He describes how the website acts as a kind of go-between, matching citizens, offering spare rooms in their houses or flats with homeless refugees.
If they're an asylum seeker, they only have 120 euros per month for the rent. And in this case, the flat sharing community will ask their friends or the parents to spend money for the room. And if there are 30 people who spend 10 euros per month, so the room is financed.
Opening your home to strangers might make some wary, but David Sistel is alert to the need for stakeholders to feel safe about the process.
Now we make sure we met the flat sharing community before and then they get to know each other, and if they don't like each other, so the person doesn't move in.
The Refugees Welcome Project offers a vital lifeline, says Sabine Kaldorf, who works for the local NGO Save Me. It's especially important for the challenges refugees face when starting a new life in a foreign country.
Especially in our part of Germany, housing is rare. Refugees are competing with students and they're competing with other people with low salaries. By now, we have several thousands of refugees that have already been accepted and therefore want to integrate and are not housed by the city of Bonn anymore. I think that this is a group that most urgently needs a project like this.
So far, more than 350 refugees have found a room in shared flats or houses through the organizations. For the last few months, Abdul has been living with Selina and three other German housemates.
Actually, I didn't really think about it. I just said, okay, let's get to meet him and see what happens.
I am happy here. I have so much friend here. We watch movie, hang out a little bit. Yeah, sometimes we have parties.
I think we're friends now.
I think in the first time also to anyone, if he is new, he will prefer to be with flat like or WG because these people help him even in small things. These people, they are now my family.
The voice of Abdul, a so far successful participant in the Refugees Welcome Project in Germany, speaking with the BBC's Julia Lorck. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry. When you think of archaeology, you might have images of Indiana Jones flashing through your head, or people hunched over ancient artifacts in a dimly lit room. But what if you could see prehistoric ruins from space? Well, there actually is something called satellite archaeology, and the 2016 TED Prize this year went to SatArc scientist Sarah Parktak of the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
The prize comes with $1 million and recognizes her work using satellite imagery to monitor archaeological sites in ancient Egypt. Parktak is founding director at the University of Alabama's Birmingham Laboratory for Global Observation, using high-resolution images from space to track things that are hard to see from the ground.
Her first successes have been hunting criminals, looters, not treasure, yet.
Just after the Arab Spring started in Egypt in late January 2011, we started hearing rumors about looters going after archaeological sites near Cairo. And it's one thing to hear rumors or eyewitness reports. It's another thing entirely to be able to capture that data from space. Images don't lie. We've got a lot of before data for many sites in Egypt. And what we do is look at the after data, and we look for small dark circles or squares surrounded by a donut shape of earth, which indicates recent digging. And they look very, very different from excavation units. So it's really this comparative before and after imagery analysis that shows us exactly where looters have been digging pits.
Now, are you taking pictures of the barn with the doors open and the horses gone? I mean, how do you act on that data?
So we don't know what the looters have taken, just because it's like any excavation. You don't know what you're going to find until you dig. But what we do know is that there are a lot of intact tombs in Egypt, or partially intact tombs. Let's face it, looting has been going on for thousands and thousands of years in Egypt, really since ancient Egypt. And we know that the looters are targeting specific sites that have tombs with a lot of objects in them. What really concerns me is oftentimes you see looters come in, they go after a looting pit, and after a while the sand blows in. So obviously that hole is covered up. But a lot of pits remain open. And in Egypt, you know, this is a civilization that lasted for thousands of years, and as a result has just millions of tombs. And oftentimes these tombs would be built one on top of the other. So when looters come in and keep a hole open, and we see that hole remain open, it worries me because I wonder, they've tunneled down, and are they going deeper and deeper and going after other tombs? That's something I can't see from space.
Can you dispatch Egyptian authorities to the site in time to get enough forensic evidence to apprehend criminals?
So I collaborate very closely with Egypt's Ministry of Antiquities, and they have this incredible department led by my friend Ali Ahmed. It's Egypt's Recovery and Repatriation Unit. And what we're doing is we're sharing all of our satellite data with them, showing them exactly where in Egypt is being targeted by the looters, because they've got a really robust database of thousands of objects that they've recovered from people attempting to smuggle them out of Egypt. And we're trying to match up the data, trying to figure out where these pieces are coming from. And in some instances, we're making them aware of looting going on at sites where they simply had no idea. ultimately, the plan, you know, long term, is can we use small satellites or new satellite data to capture looting going on in almost real time so that we can actually do something about it and get the people that are doing the looting.
Why do you think the TED folks gave you this prize? What is it about your work that they're honoring?
I think in this particular case, the timing is really important. You know, clearly for the past 2 years, and especially this year and this summer, we've seen massive destruction of archaeological sites and looting by ISIL in Syria and Iraq. These, you know, incredibly iconic sites like Palmyra have been ransacked, or they've had, you know, these beautiful features on them blown up by ISIL. And I think with climate change, with urbanization, you know, there's so many threats to archaeological sites around the world. And we're really at a tipping point with protecting our shared global heritage. You know, we've got all the tools and all the technologies and all the knowledge to protect the sites. And if we don't do something about it, so many of these sites are just simply going to be gone.
Do you have plans for that $1 million that the TED Prize gives you?
So I will make my wish to the world on Tuesday, February 16th in the evening. And the talk will be streamed live for the world to see. So I encourage folks to go to TED.com and go to TED Prize, where they can sign up to get information about my wish and be notified when I'm going to be speaking. And I would encourage everyone to listen.
It's kind of an exciting time to contemplate things like TED wishes, I would think.
I am so thrilled and honored to be able to do this. And when I heard that I'd won, I just felt this very heavy weight on my shoulders. You know, archaeology is a field where we're literally still citing papers and articles that came out 100 or almost 200 years ago. That's still relevant today. So to us, everyone who's come before us is still very much alive. And I definitely carry that with me. You know, I feel like this award is about my field. And you know, everyone loves archaeology. Everyone wants to be an archaeologist when they're little. And I think we need to tap into that excitement of discovery, because these kids are all brilliant. They're all tech savvy. They've got huge hearts. We archaeologists will be able to hopefully use that to be able to save these sites for these kids, because they deserve it.
Finally, are you worried that the good that you're doing would lead to more acceptance of government surveillance using satellite data and corporate surveillance of people using satellite data?
So this is actually a big debate that's going on right now, both in the archaeological world and clearly more broadly. And I think that runs both ways. People want their privacy, of course. But on the flip side, we can use this data to monitor people doing a whole range of illegal activities, whether it's looting, whether it's illegal fishing, whether it's illegal land development. So there's some give and take that we have to think about. And you know, certainly in my world, the looters are already using satellite data to find sites. So we've got to try to stay one step ahead of the looters. And I think these are all going to be pretty serious issues that we have to consider.
Sarah Parkak, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Parkak is a satellite archaeologist and founding director of the University of Alabama at Birmingham's Laboratory for Global Observation.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. An accident I-10 eastbound at 7th Avenue causing a considerable backup. The HOV lane is blocked. We'll stay sunny for the rest of this afternoon, and we may reach 80 degrees. Currently sunny and 79 at 252.
KJZZ is supported by the Salvation Army, serving nearly 30 million Americans each year for 150 years, including thousands in Arizona since 1892. SalvationArmyPhoenix.org, doing the most good.
The David and Gladys Wright House in Phoenix's Arcadia neighborhood has received a lot of attention when it comes to historic preservation. But North Central Phoenix has its own interesting attraction on the path to preservation. Located near 3rd Avenue and Northern, it's known as the Rock House. John Spellman has lived in the house since 1970 and explains what it looks like and how it picked up the nickname.
The house is made solely of Malapai rock, which came, this is the dark rock. It's very dense, and the rocks are really heavy. came from Sunny Slope Mountain and up around North Mountain Park. I happened to meet the fellow who hauled the rocks. He said it took him 2 years to haul them.
Wow.
And the windows and the doors are framed with quartz, which is white. So we have dark rocks, malachite, and then quartz white framing the windows, sort of outlining them. The quartz came from the river bottom down by Central Avenue.
So as you've lived in the house for 45 years, when did it start to strike you as something that not just unique to you as a homeowner, but also had that historic feel to it, that there was something different about it?
There not being another one around, it seemed to me that it was at least unusual. And I talked with my next-door neighbor who's in the real estate business, and he said, you ought to turn this into an historic property. To do that, it means you can't make big modifications, like you can't scrape the house and put in three or four duplexes with on-street parking, which they wouldn't want to see in the neighborhood.
John, do you know anything in particular about the original owners of the house, Frank and Sarah Hilgeman?
Yes, I do. We did a little research on Frank's life. He came from Fort Wayne, Indiana, with his wife, Sarah, and his son, Robert, and there were two daughters, too. They moved here because Sarah had contracted tuberculosis, and they came here for the weather. Apparently it worked because Sarah got over it and lived to be in the 70s. They moved here in 1921, arrived on Thanksgiving, and they lived initially in a tent camp by the canal up on Butler. They lived in a house after that and then started building this one around 1921 or 1922. And the way they built it was they built the basement first and lived in there while they built the rest of the house. It must have been a heck of a project because I've done some tuck pointing and a little bit of repair, and good grief, these rocks, the house is made up for something in order of 60, 65 pounds.
So now that you've been looking into the historic preservation aspect, have you noticed any more people sort of driving by and interested or taking photos, anything like that?
As a matter of fact, there are people in the front yard 2 days ago taking pictures of the house.
And is that, I mean, how do you feel about that?
It's fine with me. There's nothing in here worth stealing, unless you're an antique nut.
John Spellman, the owner of the so-called Rock House in North Central Phoenix.
Arizona has many unique places. It has one of the largest canyons, the largest solar telescope, and the only military boneyard in the U.S.
About 5 miles south of downtown Tucson is the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. It's the headquarters of the 355th Fighter Wing and home of the A-10 Thunderbolt Jet Training Facility. Did you know Davis-Monthan Air Force Base is also the home of the largest military aircraft boneyard in the world?
There are about 3,850 airplanes in storage out here. And the facility is set up by the U.S. government to store all of the military aircraft that the military needs to store.
Rob Rain is with the 309th Aerospace Maintenance and Regeneration Group, better known as the Boneyard.
That's a name that we're kind of proud of because it means that we're doing our job.
On a windy afternoon, Rain walks me through parts of the nearly 3,000-acre facility. The Boneyard helps the government avoid millions of dollars in new parts by storing, renovating, and recycling its own aircraft.
Out of those 3,800 airplanes, about 400 to 500 of them are in a storage status that we could pull them out and make them fly again.
A portion of this military base was converted into a storage facility after World War II. By 1964, the government consolidated all the boneyards across the country here at Davis-Monthan. All military branches, NASA, and other government agencies and museums have aircraft stored here. The low humidity, minimal rainfall, and little to no severe weather conditions like tornadoes keep them in good condition.
The other part of it is the ground underneath us is very, very hard. It's caliche subsoil, so it's about 6 inches of dirt and then about 18 inches of this just stone-hard subsoil that supports the weight of the aircraft. So you don't have to tarmac over huge pieces of desert. You just park the airplanes on the desert.
Name an aircraft, and it's probably sitting here. There's a C-5A Galaxy transport plane, the largest U.S. military aircraft. There's also a ski-equipped LC-130, the very same that crashed in 1971 during a resupply mission in Antarctica, and a B-57 Canberra, like the first U.S. jet bomber to drop bombs during combat. Rob Rain says there's an interesting mystery about one aircraft here. During the first years of the human spaceflight program called Project Mercury, a C-135 airplane was used to train the Mercury 7 astronauts on zero-gravity flights. The aircraft was nicknamed Vomit Comet for its effect on pilots. Well, Rain says NASA believes that Vomit Comet is the one in the boneyard and that all 7 astronauts signed their names on an inside panel. But no one has been able to find those autographs. So, Senator John Glenn, if you're listening, it seems you're the only one who can tell us where it is. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know something that we ought to know, please tell us about it. The show at KJZZ.org.
It is a busy weekend of things to do around the Valley, Mark, including Melissa Etheridge. She's playing tonight at the Wild Horse Pass Hotel and Casino.
Hanukkah Harry is coming early this year. John Lovitz, comedian, will be doing his stand-up tonight at Stand Up Live.
The Suns will try to have a 2-game winning streak as they host the Denver Nuggets on Saturday night at Talking Stick Resort Arena.
And tomorrow night, Princess Bride, an inconceivable evening with Cary Elwes. That's at the Chandler Center for the Arts.
Now, Mark, this sounds like something up your alley. Grandparents versus grandkids tonight at 7:30.
Don't get in the middle of that. Do not get in the middle of that. The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We would love to hear from you. Let us know some ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. We hope you have a great weekend. It is 3 o'clock.